We occupied a piece of land outside of Rapid City late 81. By 1982, in the bunker sitting alongside me were people who had been on the outside of the perimeter of Wounded Knee in 1973 firing in to kill Indians. Now they're with the Indians pointing their rifles out at the feds they'd been co-opted into working for less than 10 years earlier. Well, that changed my consciousness about them. They're potentially organizable. You got to talk to them in terms and reach them in terms that make sense to them, and on that basis you can find commonalities, and they're real serious about what they do. I'd much rather have a converted bircher on my side than 9 flower children with incense and candles, okay? Trust me on that one. I would. And there's a reason for that. Okay? So, there was a dual reciprocal educational process. But you got to understand the things in terms, grab the dynamics, not impose your values like some sort of Jesuit missionary on people. This is how your life should have meaning and how you should live it, and I'm here to tell you about it. No, take them based on their perception of interest and how they're acting, and if you can find a point of intersection, make the common ground, join the action. You don't have to be best friends. You can disagree, as Derek and I have, on various points. He's changed some positions, I've changed some positions, but we're moving forward. Doesn't make us interchangeable parts. We're human beings. We've got to understand that about groups other than ourselves. We can make allies, but only if we accept allies in terms that are acceptable to the allies. And some people we can't align with at all. Okay? They're the ones the baseball bats are for. Not enough true confessions for one night? Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Well, you keep on referring to violent action. Is there a point where violence becomes unacceptable?
There's lots of points where violence is unacceptable. It's counterproductive.
No, so basically, it's just the point where it gets counterproductive, not anything else.
It's situational. Violence is a tactic. Mm-hmm. It's not a principle. It's not a test of purity. I believe in armed struggle. I participated in armed struggle. I'm getting old and feeble, but I might just do it again, okay? I've been an activist for 35 years, and in that 35 years, probably 95% of all the political action I've engaged in has been what would come under the rubric of nonviolence. I simply do not foreclose the option, and you are not going to run your guns up and intimidate me because I got guns of my own and I'll use them, okay? You'd be amazed and how much violence that actually averts. Yeah?
Yeah.
If you understand your opponent, as most of us at least rhetorically do, to be absolutely amoral, if not actively immoral, why would we appeal to the moral sensibilities of our opponent and expect to be safe in political engagement from the infliction of violence, even up to the point where we became effective enough to transform them, put them out of power? They're not going to allow that to happen, obviously. Now what are you going to do? Back down or move forward? If you move forward at the point you're actually threatening, they will kill you. Once you're dead, you're no threat. How do you move forward? Sometimes I feel like, and I've got no truck for Joe Stalin. We can go into that, but not tonight. I'm absolutely an anti-Stalinist, but I was feeling often enough in the past 10 years, say, as Stalin must have felt when he got a little communique from Gandhi saying that they should use nonviolent resistance methods against the German invasion of 1940. Those guys killed 27 million Russians. Sit down in front of them, they'll kill you all. If the opponent is actually who you say it is rhetorically, you cannot rely for a second on the idea that he won't simply kill you if you're a problem. If he's not killing you in the context, you're no problem. You're self-defeating. Those who oppress you define the terms of struggle. You don't. That's the nature of the relations of power. If they're doing it by way of armed force, then ultimately, at some point, you got to be willing to use armed force. They dictate those terms. You don't have an alternative, nor can you be nonviolent in a violent context. Okay? If you do not halt the system of imposition of violence in its track, you are complicit in violence. by virtue of your nonviolent acquiescence in the maintenance of the terms of power. That's one of those little insidious things about how power works. There is no purity in starving babies. The only point is to win, to make that stop, and that constitutes the win. Well, that's a very immediate thing, preventing the starvation of the babies. What do you have to do structurally to prevent or preclude that from happening, not only now, but ever? Can I pose a question?
Sure.
Okay, and then I'm going to let you respond to it, but I'm going to pose it and see what comes back from the group. There's this saying that's kind of fashionable out there now in the political arena, in the oppositional political arena. All right? Actually, there's two of them go to the same thing, but I'll just take the one that works best for my purposes. All oppressions dance upon the same stage. You heard it? Mixed reviews here. Well, I can tell who the really politically cutting edge rhetoricians are by the nodding heads and everybody else looking blank. Think about it for a sec. All oppressions dance on the same stage. Now, here's the question. If you're going to be effective in combating oppression, do you combat the individual dancers on the stage, or you try to yank the stage out from under the oppressions?
Burn the stage.
Spar with oppressions into eternity. Long they got a stage, by the time you're done with one, got it all beat up and subdued and not oppressing anymore, turn to the next one, that one will get back up. So got the stage.
I agree. That doesn't alter the fact that had the people in the July 1944 plot succeeded, they probably would have ended the war sooner. So it would have, I think, been a useful tactic to get rid of that one dancer.
True.
Which would not have halted the larger oppression of the system. All I'm saying is that at the same time, here's what I'm trying to say: that at the same time that you're blowing up the stage, it can sometimes be helpful to take out a dancer or two on the way before you do that.
Oh, yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
Yeah, but in your vision, how you can see, I don't disagree. And it actually ties back to something that was said a little earlier. Okay? But you used a term other than that would use. Band-aids. But they could be band-aids, but I like the imagery. Okay? But I would call them tactics. You got arena tactics, engagements. You know they're not going to accomplish the big result. They engage. If you engage your tactics correctly, you can ultimately accomplish a strategic result, but you got to have that bigger version to fit your tactics into. We're doing this, 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 and maybe something else too, and the whole idea is to bring this entire municipal government to a halt, say. But that's not going to stop the bigger one. You got to have a vision. All right? You got to have a mesh of tactics. You do what you can do, and that's probably combating the dancing oppressors. Okay, but you can't lose sight of how those tactics fit into the ultimate goal, which is to eliminate the stage. And we got people who accomplish minor results, and that's to be commended, but then they declare victory. And see, that was just a step along the way to the larger goal. And what is the goal? What is the stage here? Where we are. Not in some cosmic historical sense. Where we are right now. What's the stage upon which the oppression dances?
Capitalism.
Industrial civilization.
Okay. We're in the centerpiece of both. Okay? But the functioning edifice that allows that to work, and this may be a transient phase, it may be it's getting phased out. That's another discussion. Right now, the state entity, which allows the corporate predation, structurally speaking, is the stage. All the oppressions dance on it. But those entities stand on something else. Let me put it to you this way. If there had not been conquest and ongoing colonization of indigenous people whose land this is, whose rights have to be denied in terms of their sovereignty, but in terms also of their basic human, fundamental human rights, natural rights, if you will, If those were not violated, where then would the entity, corporate, state, or otherwise, known as the United States, be? Yeah, it has no being other than the imposition of that colonial domination upon Native North America. There is your stage. If you took the entire rest of the progressive agenda, however you want to articulate it, with racism, with sexism, with gender bias and oppression, with ageism, with classism, with environmental devastation, with militarization, you know all the isms. Every single one of them. Add them all up. And just fantasize for a moment that the power of the people, which could never be defeated when it was united, had prevailed and every one of those isms had been repealed. And we had an anti-racist, anti-sexist, anti-classist, anti-ageist, non-militarist, environmental protectionist society on our hands. You know what? It would still be an imperialist society. It would still be based on a non-recognition and non-resolution of the fundamental issue, which is the internal colonial domination of Native North America, which is requiring of a consciousness that would necessarily make the population that affected that resolution repeat everything it had opposed and transcended in its own mind. If, on the other hand, you resolve that issue, if you make that the priority, restoration of rights and jurisdiction to the people whose land this is, in every area where there is not a voluntary and consensual alienation of property title, the restoration of jurisdiction means the reapplication of indigenous traditional values and relations. There is no history of sexism. We didn't even have a conceptualization of race, much less racism. We had no class. Militarism, which they try to saddle us with, is a joke. It's about like football. And we're viewed widely, if somewhat romantically at times, as being fundamentally, environmentally, ecologically conscious. Every one of the other oppressions you're talking about is eradicated by virtue of removal of the stage. So you take all those vectors of activism, but you frame them in terms of consciousness of an overall goal which goes way beyond battered women's centers, policing the police, basic litigation to control the corporate dogs. All of those various vectors of activism you can see, if they are coordinated in a way consciously designed to achieve the one reasonable goal, which is not the U.S. out of Iraq, which is not the U.S. out of Afghanistan, which is not the U.S. out of Central America or the Caribbean or Southern Africa or Southeast Asia, or you can take them all off, and we've had the U.S. out of every one of those as a slogan during my experience as an activist, and I've supported everyone. But we can actually get to the one that makes sense, which is U.S. out of North America. U.S. out of existence, in other words, U.S. off the planet, and that is the impossible goal, which is the only realistic option if we are going to do what it is that ultimately we have to get done. Otherwise, we just end up replicating the same thing over and over. Okay, your turn. Now, was that revolutionary? I don't want to overthrow this government. Don't want to overthrow this government. Yo, I will. Don't want to overthrow this government. Don't want to see anybody, my own included, in charge of it. Don't want it to be there when it's done. Now, is that revolutionary or what?
I guess we could talk about how we define revolutionary. I mean, I agree with your goals. Okay, I had like four things earlier. One of them is Gandhi also wrote to Hitler, asking him to stop, and was evidently surprised when he didn't. And okay, okay. After the war, he wrote that what the Jews should have done is either offer themselves to the butcher's knife or jump off a cliff. So that's the first thing about that. So he wasn't writing. He was pen pals with others besides Stalin.
Yeah, that's good.
So the next thing is that when I think about fighting or fighting back, I think of a couple people. One of whom is Nathan Bedford Forrest, who was a horrible racist and also a very good general. And somebody asked him once how he won so many battles. And he summarized all of military strategy into 6 words. Get there first with the most. And what that means is get there. You choose the battlefield first. You choose the time with the most. You have to have local superiority. And this is true on every level, from a physical battlefield to who chooses the battlefield of voting. Who made that choice? Who chooses the court system? Who chooses? And it's true in discourse. When I write, I try, this is one reason my books end up so big, is I try to anticipate every argument that can be made against it before the reader gets to it. So I try to get there first with the most arguments, so that they don't come at me later and say, you know, you missed this point right here. So that's just generic. That's how I attempt. And not all, I'm also not saying, by the way, that all discourse is battle, but in combative discourse, I attempt to keep that in mind. Get there first with the most. And I don't want to limit the discourse. Achieve local superiority, which is why the thing in Chicago was bound to fail. Well, that which brings me to the second thing. The other thing I think about in terms of fighting back, the advice comes from a baseball player, Wee Willie Keeler. Somebody asked him how he got so many hits, and he said, hit them where they ain't. And I think that's also a very important rule for all, especially guerrilla combat, is to find out where they are and hit them somewhere else. I guess those are the big things I wanted to say about that. And so far as the is there a place where is there a level of violence? What was it precisely that you asked? Is there violence that would then...
Is there a point where violence is unacceptable?
I would go back to the very first thing you said, that it's circumstantial. All life is circumstantial. I mean, that's like saying, is there a place where sex is not acceptable? Or is there a place where conversation is not acceptable? Those are all just different things, different parts of life. And there are times where it may be incredibly appropriate to do whatever it is one does, and that can change over time. I mean, that can change, certainly will change by circumstance. Well, that was a conversation killer. you didn't need to nod in agreement with that particular statement.
I mean, I don't know if I understood the thing about the question you're asking me necessarily, but I want to assert that probably rape as violence is never acceptable in revolutionary struggle. I think y'all might agree that there's a clear distinction between radical activism, right, and what real revolutionary struggle, or possibly what Ward might call devolutionary struggle, looks like, right? I'm just curious what you think, maybe some examples of that, like how that manifests either right now or historically in the United States. And how it could manifest, even.
Okay. I didn't understand it. What do you mean by radical?
So radical activism is, I think there's a distinction between that and revolutionary struggle, and we'd say radical as politics. Radical politics, people with radical ideals taking their politics and doing certain things with that, right? But where the agenda is not towards revolutionary ends. Yes. You might be like doing radical or militant things, right? Like, say, anti-globalization movement, right? As an example. People, you know, break the...
I still don't think I quite understand, but since I'm a male, I'll go ahead and answer anyway.
Alrighty, step right up to that one, didn't you?
And I would just go back, and I may once again be entirely misunderstanding your question, but I don't have a problem making any sort of I don't have a problem with actions that go halfway. I don't have a problem with celebratory parades or with confronting parades that are racist or mm-hmm. with breaking windows or with... I don't have a problem with any of that. I mean, actually, I do want to say this very quickly, that I do have one critique of the ELF, which is I think they should move up the infrastructure. They should find levers to leverage their efforts. Anyway, but so I don't have a, I don't see, I'm very, very inclusive in the tactics that I see are acceptable. I mean, for crying out loud, I went to a county fair about a month and a half ago and sat there passing out flyers for a local environmental organization, and I mean, at a county fair, and how much difference did that make? I mean, I'm sure it's zero, and I mean, I did it, you know, and it's so I'm very inclusive as long as the people who do less are accepting of those who actually. There's something I want to read very quickly.
Read it.
Okay. It arises from the question. I gave a talk one night. Actually, I gave a talk one afternoon and then one night. And this one woman came to both of the talks to accuse me of being a combination of Mao, Pol Pot, and Stalin.
Wow.
Because I want to deindustrialize, and her historiography is all wrong. Yeah, yeah. And it doesn't alter the fact that a lot of people rely for their food on industrial civilization. Mm-hmm. And when I talk about bringing down civilization, there will someday be far fewer people on the planet than there are now. And I got to page 400 or something of this new book, which is 1,300 pages. And I got stuck because I couldn't go forward without recognizing the fact that no matter what we do, we're participating in mass murder. Because if you participate in the system, you're going along. And if you bring the system down, people are going to die. What do you do with that? And I got an answer that I'm very happy with. If you've gotten this far in the book, or if you're simply anything other than entirely insensate, we probably agree that civilization is going to crash, whether or not we help bring it about. If you don't agree with this, we probably don't have anything to say to each other. How about those Red Sox? We probably also agree that this crash will be messy. We agree further that since industrial civilization is systematically dismantling the ecological infrastructure of the planet, the sooner civilization comes down, whether or not we help it crash, the more life will remain afterwards to help support both humans and non-humans. There will be people sitting on the banks of the Columbia 50 years from now going, there are no salmon here. There was a hell of a lot of calories coming up here, and I'm starving to death so that those in power could make cheap aluminum for beer cans. God damn you. They will be saying that. I guarantee that. If you agree with all this, and if you don't want to dirty your spirituality and conscience with the physical work of helping to bring down civilization, and if your primary concern really is for the well-being of those humans who will be alive during and immediately after the crash, then given, and I repeat this point to emphasize it, the civilization's going to come down anyway, you need to start preparing people for the crash. Instead of coming to my shows and attacking me for stating the obvious, go rip up asphalt and vacant parking lots to convert into neighborhood gardens. Go teach people how to identify local edible plants, even in the city, especially in the city, so these people won't starve when the proverbial shit hits the fan, they can no longer head out to Albertsons for groceries. Set up committees to eliminate or, if appropriate, channel the additional violence that might break out. We need it all. We need people to take out dams. We need people to knock out electrical infrastructures. We need people to working to ensure that, we need people to protest, chain themselves to trees. We also need people working to ensure that as many people as possible are equipped to deal with the fallout when the collapse comes. We need people working to teach others what wild plants to eat, what plants are natural antibiotics. We need people teaching others how to purify water, how to build shelters. All of this can look like supporting traditional local knowledge. It can look like starting rooftop gardens. It can look like planting local varieties of medicinal herbs, and it can look like teaching people how to sing. The truth is that although I do not believe that designing groovy eco-villages will help bring down civilization, when the crash comes, I'm sure to be first in line knocking on their doors asking for food. People taking out dams do not have a responsibility to ensure that people in homes previously powered by hydro know how to cook over a fire. They do, however, have a responsibility to support the people doing that work. Similarly, people growing medicinal plants do not have a responsibility to take out dams. They do, however, have a responsibility at the very least to not condemn those people who've chosen that work. In fact, they have a responsibility to support them. they especially have a responsibility to not report them to the cops. It's the same old story. The good thing about everything being so fucked up is it matters where you look. There's great work to be done. Do what you love, do what you can, do what best serves your land base. We need it all. This doesn't mean that everybody taking out dams and everybody working to cultivate medicinal plants are working toward the same goal. It does mean that if they are, each should see the importance of the other's work. Further, resistance needs to be global. Acts of resistance are more effective when they're large-scale and coordinated. The infrastructure is monolithic and centralized, so common tools and techniques can be used to dismantle it in many different places, simultaneously if possible. By contrast, the work of renewal must be local. To be truly effective, acts of survival and livelihood need to grow from particular land bases where they will thrive. People need to enter into conversation with each piece of earth and all its human and non-human inhabitants. This doesn't mean, of course, that we can't share ideas, that one water purification technique won't be useful in many different locations. It does mean that people in those places need to decide for themselves what will work. Most important of all, the water in each place needs to be asked and allowed to decide for itself. Oh, by the way, I have a new slogan, which is dismantle globally, renew locally. I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway. There is no moral reason, by the way, not to take out every cell phone tower you see. And I see now, by the way, cell phone towers kill between 5 and 50 million migratory songbirds per year. Also, the asshole at the next table can talk about his latest stock deal while you're trying to eat. Anyway, I've been thinking a lot again about the cell phone tower behind Safeway, and I see now how these different approaches manifest in this one small place. The cell phone tower needs to come down. It is contiguous on two sides with abandoned parking lots. Those lots need to come up. Gardens can bloom in their place. We could even do our work side by side. I don't know if that has anything to do with your question.
But it sounds.
But if it doesn't, it should. What, you want me to respond to it too?
If you want, I mean.
I don't really think between what I've said before and the fact that there's nothing there I disagree with that I'd have much to add to it, actually.
Yeah. I could, I thought of, like, while stuff was happening, kind of a better premise to go on, right? As an example, what I was thinking about. I was thinking about, like, what I think is the most revolutionary organization of modern history in the United States as a Black Panther Party. And, like, when I say most revolutionary, most effective revolutionary organization.
Okay.
And I kind of feel that the failure of the, like, Black Panthers and of revolutionary intercommunalism or Black nationalism or whatever kind of lends itself, like, maybe also on the state a lot, but also on the backs of white radicals. And what I was thinking about was that as revolutionary struggle and SDS and essentially the failure of white radicalism as activism to create a revolutionary struggle to support the Black Panthers. And that's kind of what I meant when I...
Okay, I think that was
well.
In there, where you don't necessarily do this work, but you're obligated to support those who do, and vice versa. I mean, there's no purity in armed struggle.
Oh, definitely.
Okay, but there's no purity in pacifism either. There's a purity in a victory that feeds starving children and prevents the culminating rape of the planet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's where the purity is. Now, the question is how you get there, and that's Malcolm X. By any means necessary. I could add available, but you make the availability, so it's the necessary part that prevails. Yeah. She just voted again.
I think she has a question. Is there
a question?
No,
we are.
So we
do. Okay, then.
Any more questions? How are we doing for time, by the way?
Yeah, we got a while. It's running out, but we got a few minutes yet if there's anything left.
Earlier, Derek mentioned violence going down. Is that written already in one of your books?
That's in the new book.
The 1300 pager?
Yeah.
All right.
One of the things they do in that book, one of the things they do in the new book that I'm really proud of is that since the first rule of propaganda is if you can slide your premises by people, you've got them. An example of that would be you hear some talking head say, how can we make the economy grow? Premise one, we want the economy to... How can we make the U.S. economy grow, he says. Premise one, we want the U.S. economy to grow. Premise two, we want the U.S. economy to exist. Premise three, who the hell is we? And
that's a really serious question.
Yeah, it's a huge question. Well, we'll talk about that in a second. So one of the things I do in the new book is I try to lay out the premises I lay out the premises in boldface so that people can agree or disagree with them. Because if you disagree with my premises, my arguments don't matter. And I won't go through the whole thing because there's a ton of them, but first premise, industrial civilization is not and can never be sustainable. Second premise, traditional, which, well, I was in a car one time with a friend of mine, and I said, if you could live at any level of technology you wanted, what would it be? And his friend was in a, he's kind of a jerk sometimes, and he said, that's a really stupid question, Derek. You can fantasize whatever you want, but the truth is there's only one level of technology sustainable, and that's the Stone Age. And we will be there again someday, and the only question is what's left of the world when we get there. Because any level of technology that requires, I mean, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that any way of living that's based on the use of non-renewable resources ain't gonna last. Duh. You know, it takes anybody but a rocket scientist to figure that one out. And by the same token, any way of living that's based on the non-renewable use of renewable so-called renewable resources, because of course salmon don't perceive themselves as resources, but we'll use that for shorthand. Any way of life where there are fewer salmon return every year than returned the year before is not sustainable. And so industrial civilization, my favorite first line of any book is Stanley Diamond's In Search of the Primitive, Civilization Originates in Conquest Abroad and Repression at Home.
Could you repeat that again?
Civilization Originates in Conquest Abroad and Repression at Home. Second premise.
Thanks.
Traditional communities do not often voluntarily give up or sell the resources on which their communities are based until their communities have been destroyed. They also do not willingly allow their land bases to be damaged so that other resources, gold, oil, and so on, can be extracted. It follows that those who want the resources will do what they can to destroy traditional communities. Third premise. Our way of living, industrial civilization, is based on requires will collapse very quickly without persistent widespread violence. Blah, 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 blah. And it defines civilization in there, too. I guess I'll go into that for a second. That I've been bashing civilization for about 10 years, and when I wrote this book, it's like, geez, I better finally define it. And so the definition that I use is civilization is a way of life characterized by the growth of cities. And that's defensible historically, linguistically, everything. Civilization comes from the root civitatis, which means city. Okay, that's fine, Derek, but what's a city? I've defined a city as a collection, not a community, but a collection of people living in numbers large enough to require the importation of resources. So under this definition, the Talua, on whose land I now live, were not civilized because they lived in villages, camps. They did not require the importation of resources. Two things happen as soon as you require the importation of resources. One is that your way of life can never be sustainable, because if you require the importation of resources, and I'm not talking about trading shells for buffalo robes, because that's not requiring. That's simple economic transaction. That's true free trade. But if you require the importation of resources, that means you've denuded the landscape of that resource, and so as your city grows, you will denude an ever larger area. The second thing it means is that if you require the importation of resources, your way of living must be based on violence, because if you require the importation of resources, trade will never be sufficiently reliable. Because if the people in the next watershed over, if you need something from their watershed and they won't trade you for it, and you need it, you will take it. Which means we could all become junior bodhisattvas, and the U.S. military would still have to invade countries all over the world to get our oil. And so I go through the premise, and I want to say one more thing, which is that, and you sort of gave me a look about the word we and our and said that was important. And one of the most important things I think we can do, this has to do with the whole identification thing, is to start by paying attention to when we say we. And I had a friend the other day say, how much longer do you think we're going to be in Iraq? And I said, I thought we were in Northern California. And then the friend said, no, our troops. I said, I've got troops? Shit. I mean, okay, so can I move back to the Columbia River? And the friend said, you know what I mean. And it's like, no, what? You have troops. Are they yours? And I mean, so I think it's really important that we stop saying our culture, actually. It's the dominant culture. Whatever. We stop identifying with it. It's not our government. And it's never been our government. And that doesn't mean the whole voting thing. People sometimes ask me if I'm going to vote, and I always respond that we all have secret vices that we're ashamed of. And, you know, some people use drugs, some people really, you know, compulsively masturbate or something, and I vote, you know? I'm sorry.
They wind you up, and there you go. Energizer Bunny.
Well, it's not as fun as masturbation, but
I agree.
we should probably stop this line of...
Immediately.
Yeah. I recognize it's useless, but it's still, I mean, it's something to do. I mean, I live in a small town, what can I say?
Me, I laugh. I turn on TV and I watch and I laugh. Okay.
God, what was your original question?
If there was the concept of the violence only going downwards.
Which that's in the new book, and it's one of the premises.
The title?
The title right now is Endgame, The Collapse of Civilization, Rebirth of the Community. Endgame, but it's probably not going to be that in a year. I mean, the publishers will decide it. They always
finagle the title.
The publishers. Is that true with your books too? The publishers choose titles?
No. No way. Huh. They're free to suggest.
But you have final say over that?
You bet.
Okay, I'm going to start doing that.
Yeah. You'll end up with better titles.
How about cover? Do you have veto over cover too?
Yeah, I got veto. I used to sort of.
Better agent.
Yeah, I got better book designers working now, so I don't tend to be as directly involved, but I got approval, so okay. Assist on it.
Okay.
Thanks.
Yeah. They're doing things to protect our security. We need that to feel secure. Who's the we whose security is being protected here and from whom? I'm just going to leave that one. Got other people. Actually, she had to go to another meeting and had a woman here that's authoring a book on that. And it's real interesting. I'm not writing the book, so I can't give you the precision on the quote, but there's some famous writer that sometimes referring to the West, somewhere around Denver, Colorado, said, the funny thing is, there is no there. And that's what she sort of discovered. Ultimately, you peel this onion, there's nothing there, including even the people you would expect. It's the antithesis of what it purports to be. And that's a really insidious part of this we and our kind of thing that they've got. Even I knew it, and I'm otherwise perfect. No, it really is. They get you buying into things semantically. If you can conceive it that way, it really, really takes the edges off your ability to frame things sharply. And you have to frame them sharply, clearly, in order to know what it is you have to do to get where you want to go.
I want to say one more thing about that. Which is, after the end of apartheid, or the nominal end, whatever we want to say, that one of the heads of South African security, secret police, I guess is more accurate, said what he had been most afraid of from the ANC was not their sabotage nor even their violence, but the possibility that they would convince the mass of South Africans to not believe in law and order, because if they didn't police themselves, no security force in the world could contain that. And that was the single most important thing that he was afraid of.
Craig Williams, yeah.
You know, the source where I had didn't name it.
I think it was him.
I need everybody to excuse me because I kind of have I got to get going. I want to ask Derek a personal question related to what you wrote in the language book and your Crohn's disease. You heard a voice you said saying, let go. Do you remember writing that? Let go, Derek.
Keep going.
Well, I was wondering what if you've learned what it was you needed to let go of. And maybe this ties in with what the other gentleman was saying about the stage. Like, I think the stage is comfort. And I think maybe that pertains to what the other woman was asking, like, what do we do? I don't think there would be that question in America if people were willing to suffer for what they believe in. I was just wondering if you've had any more insight. You said that Crohn's disease was a teacher, and you suffered a lot hauling all those hives around. Like, that work brought you down. It brought you to a place of being teachable. Like, it humbled you. And I don't think, like, you would have learned anything if you hadn't gotten brought low. And I think Americans are really proud and they need to humble themselves. Like this American pride thing, you know, like it's something I've been dealt with. Like I've had, like I realize I have these issues too. But like, what have you learned, Derek, since you wrote that?
Well, I think I have three responses. The first one is that in my own particular life, the thing that I had to let go of was that I've heard it said that a lot of people who get abused either end up abusing others or abusing themselves. And my own direction was to turn it inward. And I was repressed. I didn't feel anger. I didn't feel any of those weird emotion things. And one of the things that, and I would turn pain off. I broke my jump foot. I was a high jumper, as you know, and I broke my jump foot, and I just kept jumping. And I jumped 6'6" on a broken jump foot. I would hop up to my mark, and then I would turn it off, and I would jump. And then I would hurt like hell afterwards. I broke my hand playing softball. I finished the game. I broke my foot playing football. I finished the game. Pretty fucking stupid. And the reason is because I turned everything off. And one of the big lessons that the Crohn's disease taught me was that if I can't control whether I go to the bathroom, there's not much in my life I can control. And it was really an opening for me to start letting go, to start feeling. I mean, if I can't beat, there was part of it too, is I could beat anything. And if I can't beat this disease, then I need to give up on the notion of beating things. And, or to give up on the notion of, that's not entirely true because there are things that are worth fighting for. I mean, it's not a black and white thing or open and shut thing, but the point is it taught me to stop attempting to maintain that level of self-control. That's one thing. Another thing it did is it killed me. And that's a wonderful thing. The central metaphor of all my work is death and rebirth. Because a wonderful thing happens, for example, when you give up on hope, which is that you realize that kind of like a Christian heaven, you never needed it in the first place. And you realize that when you give up on hope...
Also?
No, when you give up on hope, that the part of you that relied on it is now dead. And once you're dead, the logic of the Nazis doesn't work anymore. They can't touch you anymore. Once you're dead, you can still sing and you can still dance and you can still make love and you can still fight like hell, but they can't touch you. And so that's the second thing. And third thing is, oh, I think one of the most important things that one of the ways that the civilized have been able to steal the land from the indigenous, apart from the fact that they just slaughtered them wherever they could, is that they would many times demoralize them. And one of the ways that would happen is if you burn a village once, they rebuild it. You burn it again, they rebuild it. You burn it again, they rebuild it. You burn it again, they say, fuck it, I'm not fighting this anymore, I can't do it, I give up. And, I mean, that's happened in my own life about many things. And I think one of the most important things that we need to do is to attempt to demoralize the Americans, to get them to break their unshakable faith in the current system, so that when you turn on the tap water, you know it's going to go on. When you turn on the computer, you know it's going to go on. But what happens if you turn it on, if you try to turn it on and water doesn't come out? Well, fuck. Okay, it's going to come on a little while. What happens if it goes off again? Well, fuck. It's going to come on again. What happens if it goes off again and again and again and again? I think one of the things we have to do is to break their faith in the current system, to break their religious belief in the current system.
Well, so I guess whoever takes out the wire should take out the cell phone tower at the same time, like it should be coordinated, so when they call to complain.
Well, I want to say, well, yes, oh, sure.
Good idea.
I want to say one more thing about taking out water supplies. When the dams on the Colorado River eventually fail, whether humans cause them to or whether someone else causes them to, If civilization is still standing, and if the capitalist press is still running at that point, it will, of course, brag that the people in Southern California and Nevada and Arizona are really thirsty. That's bullshit. More than 90% of the water used by humans is used for agriculture and industry. And if the dams on the Colorado River go, I don't want to hear one word of complaint out of anybody so long as there exists a single golf course, a single alfalfa field, a single swimming pool, a single lawn. Once those are gone, and if people are still thirsty, then we can complain about it. That has nothing to do with Crohn's disease.
It's the result of Crohn's disease.
Yeah, I mean, Crohn's disease taught me that. I think there was a woman with a question in the far back.
Yeah, somewhere.
Okay, I guess not. And how are we doing for time now?
5 minutes. She's throwing us out in 5 minutes.
There was two people here, so.
It's really quick. Could you give maybe like one tactic or one example that you've dealt with personally in dealing with like governmental repression, whether from the FBI or you know, any other governmental agencies? What's successful? Like is there attitude, or is it like something that like you teach group cohesion, or you know, communication between groups, so you know, misinformation techniques don't.
Young man, you're planning to commit sedition, aren't you? Word of advice. We're for kindred spirits you've known for a very long time, very being a relative thing, but make it a while, okay? You know who they are, and don't make it all that many of them. Start there, okay? Don't make it somebody public like me either, all right? Lay out the idea, but, you know, pick your compatriots carefully.
What did you say?
Hard to infiltrate a close-knit group that knows each other for a long time. Most of the organizations that have been successful in doing things, I'm not going to specify what those things are, okay? Are people kind of clan-related, grew up together. They come out of small communities, okay? They got that history. Those things can still be cracked, but it decreases the probability. There's your tactic. Okay? Stay out of jail, in other words.
When I taught at the prison, I asked some of my students who had been mules,
yeah,
how they trusted the people that they worked with. And most the students I happened to ask that were, for the most part, Mexican nationals. And they all looked at me like an idiot and said, it was my brother.
Yeah.
It was somebody from my village. And I have a question for you real quick. Why haven't the feds... why haven't the feds popped you in a major way? for writing about taking out, I mean, for saying that U.S. out of North America, why have they not, why are you here?
It's a good question, actually. Part of it has to do with luck, and that's a fact. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the Denver spy file, so I hate that name. Sounds trite. Okay, the police political intelligence files from Denver Police Department, one of the documents in there was the FBI reporting to the Denver Political Intelligence Unit. In fact, they picked up information in Minnesota that a professor at this place, Glenn Morris, myself, and Russell Means were to be assassinated at the National Congress of the American Indian annual meeting in Denver. About, I guess at this point, 8 years ago. What foiled that? Well, by law, they were to let us know so we could take precautionary measures. We heard about it when they released the files. Here's what prevented it from happening, to the best of my knowledge. None of us went to the conference. That's it. I mean, the Denver PD posted people to take notes. That was their response. Well, we hope they're good shots, and we'll be sure and take accurate record of it. So it's not an absence. Maybe ineptitude, I don't know. Yeah. The Patriot Act thing, I don't know why that hasn't been invoked. That's the truth of it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, John Stockwell, somebody once asked him why he hadn't been killed. He's a CIA agent who exposed the agency, and he said because they're winning. And I think there's a lot of
truth. Well, there's something to that too.
I mean, that's why there were so many more lynchings after the American Civil War than before, is because when that entitlement was seriously threatened. I mean, that's the truth. Is when the entitlement of the American people become to exploit everything in the world gets seriously, seriously threatened, we're all toast. I mean, anybody who opposes it all is that underlying contempt will turn into outright hatred and overt hatred, I should say.
You had mentioned that when you said break the faith of Americans, do you think that it's possible through discussion and through discourse to kind of like make people realize that, or do you think it's going to take the inevitable fact that there won't be the resources around to maintain this way of living, and then that will be the only way to actually, you know, break the faith, is the actual inability
for there's no oil, there's no whatever, all the stuff that we need for civilized society. Do you think that, because to me it seems like the only inevitability, it's like I don't know what else it's going to take for people to really question it without its absence. So that's my question.
Oh, we have been very bad. We have not been repeating any of the questions.
You're right. Let's repeat them all now.
Yeah. Okay, so the question was, do I believe that it's possible to break people's faith in the system, whatever, break faith in X, through discourse, or will it only happen through the elimination of resources? And I'm sure you have an answer to this too, and my answer is it's circumstantial, that there are some people, I mean, that's why I write. Well, that's not true, because I don't write to break people's faith. I write for people who already understand how messed up everything is, and I want to give them courage to go further. I think some people can get it through, I mean, for crying out loud, I voted for frickin' Reagan, you know? I mean, I got it through things in my own life. And there are other people who will never understand. They will be standing there with how many Jews walked into the showers? There are people who will not, and this is to say nothing against them, but there are people who will walk to the very last moment. I used to have this fantasy of sort of standing on this destroyed planet and shaking some CEO and saying, you know, now do you get it? But I've since come to realize that I could probably do that, and he would stare at me uncomprehendingly and say, I don't know what the hell you're talking about. I mean, I wouldn't even get that hollow satisfaction. So there are some people who won't get it, some people through discourse, some people it's...
Right. And you give some people something to plug into at their own pace, and you never know when that's going to take hold. A lot of cases, maybe it never does, but you never know. That's arrogance to assume. You put it out as clearly as you can. Okay. In my experience, academic experience, I've had people who were right on ready for the revolution who end up, I don't know, tendon bar forever in Boulder. Basically. And I've had young Republicans who hated everything I stood for and wanted to fight about everything come back 7 years. This has actually happened. Said you were right about this, you know, and then some other things started to make sense. So you just put it out, you stay consistent, and you see where it goes. People will take it where they're going to take it. But when things happen, you give them something to plug it into, right? And I bet every one of those people that ended up in that shower at that last moment said, you know, those other guys were right.
Yeah.
Yeah. A little late for the cognition. You hope it happens a little before that. But when it happens, you give them some framework of understanding, and they'll take it somewhere. Yeah.
Okay, I guess we're out of time. Do you want to take one more?
Is there a great finale question?
Okay, man, hit it.
Okay.
Why?
this is going to take way too long. I know the answer that you're going to
get. Well, that's the shorter one.
The question is, why did we get to this point that we're at right now? Why did the system, why was it allowed for the system to get to the point where it is? And if it is taken down, how is it going to be ensured that it doesn't happen again? And the third thing is...
Well, the second one's easy, by the way.
Okay, what's the second one?
The second one is there will never be another oil age. There'll never be another iron age. The resources are gone. It won't happen. There can be little small civilizations built up again, but there will never be another global civilization. So we can throw that one out. Oh, and one more thing about that, which is that question is a valid question. I ask it a lot, but I don't ask it really very much anymore because it's kind of like saying, okay, there is a mass murderer in our house, and he's coming after us with an axe, and, you know, I'm kind of afraid he's going to come back tomorrow. It's like, let's worry about that one tomorrow.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, then this is the last question. How are you going to ensure that you don't turn into a religious figure?
Are you asking both of us?
Yeah.
Have you ever seen this sign, demon, demon, demon? You mean like Dylan's flesh-colored Christ that glows in the dark? That kind of religion? What are you talking about? We have spirituality,
leader,
both of us.
Leader of a cult.
Oh, cult leader.
Or a savior.
A savior.
Well, personally, I did not want to go like this.
No. No. Mm-mm.
If that's the point, if we are trying.
My answer to that is when people ask me, what do you want me to do? I always say the first thing is, sure as hell, don't listen to me. Because I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. And that's not true. That's not what I say. What I say is, don't listen to me because I said this afternoon. I'm doing a drive-by. I don't live here. I don't know how to live sustainably in what is now called Denver, Colorado. If you want to know how to live sustainably, go ask the river. Go ask the prairie dogs. They know how to live here. You might actually ask the human beings who live here for a long time.
If you can go to Wyoming or Montana or Oklahoma to find them, because they've been shoved both directions to make way for this wondrous creation.
So ask those who live here, including the non-humans. So that's why I won't be a religious figure, is because when people say, what are you going to do? I say, think for yourself. Which disqualifies me from being a religious figure. It's like rule three or something. And then your first one is, how did it come to get to this stage? I think partly really bad fucking luck.
I think you should write a 1,600-page book on this one. Okay.
I mean, it's kind of, I mean, that's an important, important question.
But we're already here, so.
But we're already here. I mean, the psychopath, the killer, which, by the way, I got that image from you in the first place, is in the house, and we're going, so did he come in through the screen door?
But then that's relevant to if the system's taken down, we have to figure out why it was here in the first place, and we know that it can never happen again.
I think that one's been answered about three different ways, though.
Intelligent humans, we're going to figure out some way to become.
Well, intelligent humans, we can figure out some way to get along with each other. It's like my friend Jeanette Armstrong, who's an Okanagan Indian. She said, you know, we within our communities have the same squabbles that you white people do, and. The big difference is that we know we're going to be living here for 500 years. And so I need to figure out how to get along. And so we have communal ways to resolve those disputes. And that's also with the non-humans. We have ways to get along. And so part of it has to do with recognizing we're going to get in fights, but it goes back to the first thing we said about decolonizing your mind. I mean, And then disallowing others from exploiting. That's how you stop it from happening again.
Absolutely, that.
Which seems like a good place to stop.
Seems like a real good place to stop. Okay.
So thank you for your great question. Setting this whole thing up. Karen, Jeff.